across the galaxy. This is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello and welcome to the Free Zone. It's wonderful to have all of you here tonight. Now, I gotta say, I find it rather odd that there are more listeners to this show on YouTube than any of the streams combined. So, you guys out there on YouTube, I love you. I'm so glad you're out there and listening to the show through this stream. I just wanted to let you know that you can also listen to the Free Zone through iTunes or on Stitcher, or you can go over to freemantv.com and get the RSS feed and have this straight to whatever podcast player you want to listen through. So just so you know, there are many options to listening to the Free Zone. And I want to thank all of you there on YouTube for participating in this adventure. Now, there have been many secret people behind getting my voice to you. Back in the day, I had my good friend Wes. He put me up on the podcast and started my first blog. I can't say how much I owe him. And just through the spirit of friendship, these friends have come forward. And I want to thank Josh Mouton of Collect All Five, for putting all my videos out there for you to watch. I had no idea how this was done, and this is all a big mystery to me at the time. And another voice that has another secret friend behind the scenes that has been making sure that you get to hear my voice is Olav Phillips. And he is our guest tonight. He is the host of Anomalies.net. You want to check out his work there? So much amazing stuff on the secret space program. As a matter of fact, Olav has authored a number of works. His recent book, which you should check out, is called The Secret Space Age. Secret space programs, breakaway civilizations, Nazi UFOs, SDI, and Alternative 3. And I promise you, we are going to hit upon each of those tonight. Also, Mysterious Magazine and America's Strange and Supernatural History. We got the Pyramid Speak and many, many more listed there for Olav on Amazon. Of course, you can find everything you need to know about Olav on anomalies.net. So, Olav, I want to thank you so much for allowing me to get out to the people, for being behind the scenes of the Free Zone and keeping us running. And I also want to welcome you on this amazing topic where we're going to pick up from where we left off with Dr. Sala and start to look deeper and deeper into this secret space program. So welcome to the show, Olav.
Well, thanks for having me on, Freeman. It's really an honor to be on the show. And yeah, I mean, the one thing you also need to mention is that you're on the Roku, on the Anomalies channel. If you look it up, it's a private channel, but it's free. I have a lot of your stuff on there too, so.
Well, very nice. Yeah, you see, I keep getting spread through all these technologies, and I don't even know how they work. And I love it. I love it. This is the friendship agenda at work, folks.
That's right.
All of us together, apes together strong. Right?
Yep.
All right, so let's get down to it, because you have dug deep into this secret space age, and I'm dying to know more and more about this topic. I've had my share of sightings, I've had my share of connections, and I know that there is a secret space program going on. But I wonder if you could tell us, how did we even find out about this secret space program in the first place?
Well, I mean, it's a process, right? It's not something that you figure out overnight. You know, it's a process, and it's a discovery. And, you know, it really takes a long time to kind of piece it together. I mean, there, you know, it ranges from, for example, one of the things that I found was an article that was written way back in the 70s in Sega Magazine, where they were talking, I think it was Otto Bender was talking about, you know, iconography on UFOs. And, you know, you start to look at that iconography, and then you realize that a lot of that stuff is human in origin. That you know, you look at these images that are on the sides of UFOs, and they correspond to various, mostly fascists, but various organizations, right? You've got the lightning bolts, you've got, you know,
I believe there were hieroglyphs on the I-beams that were found at the Roswell crash.
Sure, and those actually, those could have been misidentified as runes, right?
Right.
And there's a whole bunch of stuff, but, you know, it's a lot of little tiny things. And then, you know, you come across things like the M Project by FDR that was, it was a black project from the early 40s where FDR, I think he sunk something like $3 million into it. It took him like 4 years to write it, but it was basically a migration plan that, you know, they were convinced that the Earth would become uninhabitable and they were trying to figure out what to do about it. And so, you know, even FDR back in the day, you know, sponsored a secret program. $3 million in 1942 is a lot.
That is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the entire intent was to figure out how to move people around the Earth as it becomes uninhabitable and then where to go after that.
Wow. And we are going to get into a lot of that idea with the alternative three. What about Gary McKinnon? Now, didn't he bring a lot of this to the surface? And what did you think of his research? Or his hacking, I should say. It wasn't really research. Right? Okay, we got a guy here who hacked the DOD using a phone modem. Isn't that correct?
Yes. Yes, he used a modem. Well, I think that what McKinnon found, there are two things about McKinnon that are interesting, right? One is that what he found was the kind of leftover material of a massive bureaucracy. And, you know, when we think about things that are secret, right, you know, you get kind of these, you know, these kind of visions of people carrying around like architectural diagrams or schematics of missiles or planes or, you know, secret movement orders or what, you know, who's going where to do what and assassination programs and all this other stuff. And that all exists. But the thing that people forget is that behind all that interesting conspiracy stuff, right, is a logistics operation. They move ammunition from point A to point B. They have to feed the troops. They have to issue orders. They have to, you know, arrange for cars. They have to buy electricity, you know, get cell phones, all that stuff. And so some of what McKinnon found was the leftovers of that. There were orders to move people around, or there were orders to move material around. I mean, very logistical stuff. And in a bureaucratic society, that's the kind of stuff that we all forget about, right? That, you know, even if you know it's secret, it's the kind of stuff, well, who cares if I move six cases of pencils? Well, that could be significant for some reason. And in this case, it was significant because, you know, he would find documentation stating, well, there were six cases of Ticonderoga number two pencils that moved from, you know, secret spaceship one to secret spaceship two, right? But it was that kind of leftovers, and I find that striking. The other thing about McKinnon that I found interesting is that out of all the people that have ever been gone after by the U.S. government for hacking, this was the worst. I mean, they wanted him dead.
Yeah, they threw the book, the boot, and everything they could at him.
They stated publicly straight up that they were going to throw him in Guantanamo. And you think about Kevin Mitnick, you know, he did far more damage. And he hacked into far more stuff. And what do? They sent him to prison for like 5 years. He gets out. Now he's a computer security consultant that can't touch a computer.
Right, right. Okay. All right. That makes loads of sense. And then there's Snowden. I mean, how much publicity in mainstream media does this guy get?
Right. He gets a lot. But the whole Snowden scenario, you know, you have to ask yourself what's really going on. I mean, as long as he's in Russia, nothing will happen to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
If he leaves.
So I absolutely took note of that with Gary McKinnon. They did not play around with him. They came after him full board. And people were standing up in arms against this.
It's true. And the British government, you know, departed. The English say that if America catches a cold, Britain sneezes. And in this case, they didn't. They said, you know what, you're sick, I'm leaving. And they defended McKinnon. But, you know, the veracity of which they went after him. You know, it makes you wonder. And sometimes, you know, conspiracy stuff is just so subjective, but sometimes you can't use a negative to prove a positive, but sometimes you can, you know, you can look at the actions of somebody, and although you can't completely determine what motivated it, their actions speak volumes for their agenda. And, you know, maybe, I mean, I'll never know for certain what he did or didn't get right, but the the commitment that the U.S. government made to killing him or putting him in prison for the rest of his existence tells me that something that he found in there was real.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, let's discuss the reasons behind a secret space program. Alternative sure. 3, or the concept of a coming global catastrophe. You know, a lot of people don't know that the movie The Day After Tomorrow, where the whole Earth freezes in an ice age, was based on Art Bell's book, The Coming Global Superstorm.
With Whitley Strieber.
Right. Another curious connection there. We have the potential of destruction around us at any moment, at any time. We have near-Earth objects, potential of asteroid strikes. We have a potential second sun heading towards our planet. G1.9 seems to be like a sun that is possible. Dwarf suns that we can't see unless we use certain like WISE telescopes to be able to see. And the idea of the devastation of planet Earth on all levels. So I guess if you have any scenarios that I didn't mention for our coming end, and then the purposes that this would lead them to start this mission, and then how far has it gone? That's pretty much where we're going with this. So you had mentioned FDR, the idea of Project M, and the idea that we need to do something to colonize another planet because something is coming. Do you have any ideas of what's coming down the pipe and different scenarios? And let's talk about Alternative 3 and how that may have secretly been telling us what was coming.
Well, I mean, there are a bunch, right? There's coronal mass ejections. There are X-ray pulses from space. I mean, there's, you know, the coming galactic superwave is a theory I've always enjoyed from Paul LaViolette and his work with pulsars, you know. But
talk about that for just a minute, because, you know, I've always felt that all of the ancient structures on the planet, they watch long time. You know, the planets or the structures of the pyramids or of Peru are designed in order to watch long ages of time. And I feel like there is a group of people on this planet who absolutely understand galactic weather. And this would be weather that occurs over, you know, 56,000 years.
Right.
And so this pulsar wave, would this be something that would, you know, would be known about from the ancient past?
Because, oh yeah,
yeah. Pulsars are pretty regular.
Well, I'm not the greatest. I mean, I've read LaViolette's books. I'm not the greatest guy to represent LaViolette. It's better if he explains it. But the basic idea, right, is that there's a super wave of energy that's put out from the center of the galaxy.
Ah, yeah.
Right. And that this shock wave is going to hit us eventually.
Gotcha.
And okay. That, you know, like when Fukushima happened, right, that was a predecessor shock wave. And it comes at regular intervals. That's why if you look at, well, the article I wrote in or the chapter I wrote in the Pyramid Speak is about how, you know, all the pyramids on the Earth pretty much are around the Pacific Ocean, and they all look pretty much the same. Right. At the end of the day, they're all basically step pyramids, and you can see there's only a few that are not on the Pacific Rim, but everything's pretty much on the Pacific Rim, or it migrated to the Pacific Rim. And they're also hardened, you know, they're relatively hardened facilities from something hitting you, right, physically. But LaViolette believes that the pulsars that we see are actually a communication network, and the way that they actually send pulses is using a gravity lens. I want to say it's a gravity lens that by a star, and that and those the speed of the pulses is actually like a beacon. So it's a communication and navigation network, and there's a interesting distribution of pulsars as you move toward the, you know, toward the center, and you move out toward the edge of the galaxy, because we see the ecliptic on the side, so we can see it sideways, and there's an actual a uniform distribution of pulsars, you know, depending on your distance from the core. And he thinks that some of them are actually warning beacons that this thing's coming. And there are a few nebula that exist that he thinks were byproducts of those of this shockwave, that it had detonated a series of stars and those stars turned into a nebula. But in our case, he believes that it's hit here before, and that it, I mean, you know, it scours. It's like a huge electromagnetic pulse, and it'll fry everything with any kind of circuitry.
Without a doubt, there has been cyclical catastrophes happening on planet Earth, and obviously our leaders are preparing for this.
But he tracked it all the way back, right? He compared it to a lot. He has a PhD in systems theory, so he looked at it systemically, obviously, and he compared it to, you know, ancient mythology. He compared it to, you know, like tarot decks, how they represent destruction, a lot of different methods. So, I mean, he's fascinating. You know, you got to give him a couple hours. So, I mean, it's really interesting stuff. I really love his work. From alternative three, if you see it as a blueprint, it's pretty straightforward that, you know, you're going to see a period of climate change.
Before we begin in that, let's explain to the public what alternative three was, because right now they're probably thinking it was an actual government program.
Well, basically alternative three was a television show, broadcast in 1977. It was originally supposed to be broadcast April 1st, but I think it was broadcast in like June. It was simulcast in Scandinavia, Australia, Canada, England, and a couple other places. And basically what it was is it was the final episode of a thing called Science Report. And Science Report had done a series of shows on various science topics that were designed to kind of educate the public on various scientific things. And this was the last one, so they decided to play a prank on everybody, supposedly, right? And what it was is it's a mockumentary that basically talks about the end of the world and what the government's doing about it. I mean, that's the short synopsis. A lot, you know, it is a mockumentary. The people in it, you will actually recognize some of them. Shane Rimmer, the guy who plays the astronaut Bob Groden, you know, he was in UFO and a bunch of science fiction shows from the 70s in England. I mean, you'll recognize him. The guy who was the presenter was actually a real presenter, a host. That's what they call them, presenters. He actually, in England, you can't be an actor and a presenter because they think that it's a conflict of interest. So he actually left his job as a presenter to act in this movie, and then he went back to being a presenter. So people actually knew who he was.
Right. And this is because actors are technically called hypocrites. And you can't have a hypocrite as a special science representative or a presenter.
A presenter of news and views, right?
Yeah.
So
what were some of the scenarios that they outlined for the catastrophe? Well,
there's one main scenario. So basically the idea is that through, you know, it's a very controversial topic how you get there. So I'll leave the how you get there to the listener to imagine. But eventually you end up with a situation where the climate has changed in certain areas. It's massive famine and dryness, and other places it's torrential rains. And they show these clips of torrential downpours and, you know, rotting carcasses of cattle and deserts and this kind of thing.
Sounds like Texas and California.
Yes, it does. And then the Pacific Northwest and the Upper Midwest. But and then what this eventually leads to is a ice age. That the eventual outcome of it is an ice age.
Right. So they've been on top of this thing for a long time. And this whole global warming scam, I mean, I don't want to get into that topic. It's just,
well, it's interesting how far back it goes. I mean, you can talk to certain people, you know, and they'll go even further back. But what I know, you know, is in the late 50s, in 57, there was a meeting of the American Chemical Society. And this is significant because when you look at alternative three, right, there are three alternatives to deal with the problem. And there's a whole, like, mythos that you learn as you watch the film, that there was a secret government meeting and that the three alternatives came out of the meeting. Well, there was a secret meeting at the American Chemical Society. They had a secret meeting, just like they say in the movie. But there was a guy... back then, I forget his name now, but he was a oceanographer and a biologist, marine biologist, and he studied phytoplankton. And in 1957, he realized that the phytoplankton that existed in 57 were no longer capable of carbon dioxide scrubbing. And when you look at the literature, the phytoplankton are seen as this massive scrubber in the ocean. That, you know, we breathe out carbon dioxide, we generate carbon dioxide, the earth generates carbon dioxide, whoever generates carbon dioxide. Well, the phytoplankton scrub it. They clean out the carbon dioxide, and then so do the trees, right? And this is a kind of a natural system that creates equilibrium. Well, what he realized in 1957 was that the phytoplankton could no longer scrub enough carbon dioxide out of the air because the population's too big, too much industrialization, volcanic activity, sunspots, people jumping up and down, whatever. They couldn't handle it anymore. So at that point, they knew that we were screwed and that these things were going to happen. Right. So according to alternative three, the theory is that they created three alternatives to try to address the problem. The first one was to detonate a nuclear weapon at high altitude to try to vent the carbon dioxide, which is seen as the primary problem, into space. And it sounds idiotic, you know, in 2015, it sounds idiotic to do something like that. Even a school child would know that that's idiotic, right? But in the early 50s, or in the late 50s, you know, these are the same guys who came up with plowshares, where they said, well, you know what, we got all these nuclear weapons laying around. Why don't we use them to make harbors and canals, and we can make 10 times the size of the Suez Canal in like 15 minutes. And they actually did it. They detonated a nuclear weapon in Alaska, I believe, to create a huge harbor. And the harbor, it's a beautiful deep water harbor. It's amazing. It's circular and it's perfectly in line. And nobody can live there for 10,000 years.
Yeah.
Right. So the same brainiacs thought this one up. So it turns out that they did do something like that, that there was a project called Argus, where they had assembled a fleet in like 6 months. Usually these projects took like 2 years to plan. They assembled a fleet and executed the project in 6 months, which is completely unheard of. They went down to the South Pacific. They fired this thing off ostensibly to test for something called the Christofalos effect, where this guy, a physicist named Christofalos, believed that if you detonated a large nuclear weapon at high altitude, it would create an artificial Van Allen radiation belt. Well, they did it, and it did create the Van Allen radiation belt, but the carbon dioxide failed to vent. Hmm. So it's seen as a failure, right?
Right.
So the second thing that they did, I call it alternative 1.5, is a massive program of geoengineering. And this is actually the programmed modification of the Earth and its subsequent systems, right? And one of the things that they started doing, even back in the early 60s, was to start to manipulate the air. That you see patents coming out of Hughes Aircraft and, you know, Grumman and a lot of other people, you know, Martin Marietta, where they're talking about manipulating the atmosphere and doing things. And basically chemtrails. And one of the things that they were very worried about was dumping particulate at high altitude to reflect the change of reflectivity of the Earth, the albedo, to decrease the amount of sunlight coming in and lower the surface temperature of the Earth. Again, sounds insane, right? But what they discovered is that in 9/11, when 9/11 happened, and they grounded all the aircraft, this was the first time in recorded history that they'd actually grounded all the aircraft. I mean, there were fighter planes even here. There was like, you'd see an F-16 fly by every once in a while, or, you know, whatever. Here, mostly F-18s, but, you know, you'd see a plane, a military plane fly around every once in a while. But they pretty much grounded everything else. What they realized, all these atmospheric scientists ran outside and said, oh my God, there's no airplanes. There's no smog from the airplanes, whatever. So let's test it. And they actually realized that there were multiple percentage increases in the surface temperature of the Earth. So what that means is that when the aircraft started flying again, the temperature of the Earth started to decrease again. And the actual amount of sunlight, they measured the amount of sunlight increased when there were no aircraft flying. It's called global dimming. And so they realized that you know, these are hardcore scientists, realize that, you know, they attribute it to just leftover particulate from the engines, kind of like, you know, a smoky car, right? But
right.
The reality is that there's probably stuff mixed into the fuel.
Yeah.
That's why you'll never find, well, occasionally you see people who claim to have been part of the program, but they never eventually stand up to scrutiny. And I think that's because, I mean, maybe they do put little nozzles and stuff on airplanes, but, you know, nobody's ever concretely, like, got the smoking gun that that's what they do. And I think that the global dimming phenomenon is so pervasive that I suspect it's some sort of additive in the fuel. They've been working on it for 50 years. I think they could put an additive in the fuel.
Yeah, and this is true because I've interviewed all of the experts that I can find from the moment I began. And not yet has anyone ever come forward with a chemtrail pilot like that. Right. That would be the ultimate show for me, right? Is to actually have a chemtrail pilot. And
because they're all chemtrail pilots, I think.
Right. Well, yeah, there's many questions there and probably not the scope of this show.
No.
But so, go on.
So alternative two, they realized that between 1 and 1.5, they couldn't fix it. They couldn't stop it. They can only slow it. So two was to build bunkers, and to build bunkers like crazy. And I, you know, I'm no bunker building expert, you know, but I think there's plenty of evidence that there's plenty of bunkers out there. I mean, if you look at Raven Rock Site R, that facility is so large that not only does it have a gift shop, it has a Starbucks.
Hmm.
And they've actually put enough stuff into the Starbucks to support a multi-year underground existence where you can still get your caramel macchiato.
And you guys know, for the public listening, that there are many subterranean cities and towns in the world. This is not even a secret program. There are plenty of subterranean towns and places, but these are beyond, right? This is just...
Right. And it's actually interesting that there's a guy named David Pollitz that does, I hope I pronounce his name right. I'm a big fan, but he does these fantastic books about mysterious disappearances in national parks.
Right.
And I was looking at his website one day and, you know, you hear the rumors of all these underground cities, basically, and high-speed rail networks and that being the buzz and Taos and all that stuff. And I was looking at it. He had a map where he had actually put little markers where all the people disappear, right?
Yeah.
And I took that map and I overlaid it onto a map done by a guy named Tal in, like, 91, where he had – it was a subset of his actual master map, but he had – put all these underground bases in the paths of the rail networks. And when you put the two on top of each other, they basically match.
Wow.
They're slightly off, but they basically match.
Now that's bizarre.
Yeah.
Because I just had Dr. Sala on the show, and he's talking about human slave trade to extraterrestrials. And
yeah, I don't buy that.
Yeah. But, you know, you got to wonder, well, you know, why these people would be disappearing around these subterranean bases.
I don't think it's human slave trade to extraterrestrials. Sala's an interesting guy and he's done some interesting stuff, but I think it's human. I think it's not so much a slave trade. See, in alternative three lingo, right, they call it batch consignments. They actually have a term for it. They're called batch consignments. They're basically like people you pick up off the street. Or, you know, as I pointed out in the book, that, you know, in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, entire villages disappear and nobody knows why, right? But you basically cart them off to wherever your facility is and you just use them as slave labor. So I
think yeah, one way or the other, yeah, it's still slave labor, right?
Slave labor, yeah.
You know,
I don't do the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
Is that right?
Well, I mean, I believe in aliens and stuff, but I don't think that that's what this is about.
Mm-hmm.
This is humans.
All right. And you
this is the will to survive.
Right. It's basically it's around this global catastrophe that every soul on this planet feels coming.
Yeah, I mean, we all know something's coming. And you can extrapolate it from there. Well, anyway, so the third option was to go to Mars, right? By way of the moon. But, you know, you look at a lot of the strange things that have gone on. There, in the 80s, in the 70s and the 80s, there was a thing called Gladio, this stay-behind soldiers. And they, you know, they were fascists. And they would blow stuff up and blame it on communists and all this stuff, right? And it's very interesting. But if you look at that conceptually, if you're going to move to Mars, for example, right, you're going to leave 99.9% of the population behind. And you can't put enough of them in bunkers. That's why Alternative 2 failed. You know, as cool as these continuity of government facilities are, you're saving thousands of people. You're not saving millions.
Right.
And, you know, the Nordic seed vaults, and they're actually like something like eight or nine seed vaults around the Earth. You know, and even the empty cities in China, you know, I was talking to somebody about this. And if you look at the empty cities in China, for example, right, the place where they put them, a few of them are along the Mongolian border. And if you actually look at the projected ice line for the coming ice age, because there's one coming, if you look at the projected ice line, these are right at the ice line. Right? Somebody thought this through and said, well, the ice is going to end here. I'll put a city over here. And that's literally where they are.
Wow.
Yeah. And if you look at the other ones, you know, they're put where... You know, if there's sea level rise, this is where the sea level rise will end. Like Hong Kong and you know, and some of the ones, well, Hong Kong's an island, but some of the cities along the coast will sink. They'll be underwater. And these empty cities will be okay. And if you look at the ones in sub-Saharan Africa that the Chinese have built, you know, they're in positions where if the weather changed, that they would be in a much more advantageous position. So, you know, somebody's thinking this stuff through. But if you think about it, right, if you have something like Gladio that's a secret operation, it's a NATO's private army, right? If you have some sort of problem, that's your world police force. Absolutely. And they're fascists.
Right.
I mean, they're card-carrying Nazis.
Yeah, and... All right, let's get to it then. Let's dig deeper and let's look at some of the foundations of this secret space program, because now we're the Nazis. And, you know, I want us to get in the next 15 minutes some of these ideas out of Solar Warden, the Black Knight, and the Nazis, of course, and how this all relates. Now, we all here on the Free Zone know well the story between paperclips, so no need to get that. Let's just go ahead and get right into some of the technologies that we're thinking about here with the secret space program. And
well, first, before we get to the technology, you know, one thing that I think is oft overlooked is Hans Kammler himself. The Kammler has been fingered for years as being the guy that ran the quintessential secret space program device that, you know, Der Risi, the test facility where they built the Bell. The Bell that supposedly crashed in Kecksburg may have been the Roswell crash, you know, the Bell, right?
Yes.
Now the guy, yeah. So for a long time, Kammler's been fingered as the man, and nobody actually can figure out what happened to Kammler because he died like eight times. He was killed like twice by the Russians, twice by us, killed himself once. I don't know. He's died in a car accident once. I mean, it's, nobody knows. So Kammler himself is a very interesting dude. He actually has a PhD in civil engineering. Granted, it's not aeronautical engineering, nuclear engineering, or whatever, but he has an engineering degree, a PhD in it, in fact. Kammler was the architect of the vast portions of the Final Solution, and he actually was the one that was responsible for building building that infrastructure.
And of course, just so the public knows, this is an SS officer we're discussing.
Yeah, an SS general.
All right.
And he was actually appointed by Himmler himself to deal with the Warsaw Ghetto. That when they flushed out the Warsaw Ghetto, Kammler was responsible for that, and he directly oversaw the creation of all the concentration camps. So to think to yourself, if you're going to have a guy that's going to run a top secret program that Himmler trusts, you know, Kammler's a guy, a sick guy. I mean, he was card carrying. He bought off on the ideology, the whole thing. And, you know, I mean, an awful, awful thing, but he would be the right guy to do it. Right.
Right.
One of the other things that people don't realize is that one of the questions I always get asked is, well, if they built the Bell, where do they go? You know, it's always this base 211, they go to Antarctica thing. It's like, well, yeah, I think they did. I mean, you know, Antarctica would have been a good option. But everybody's like, well, how did they get there? Well, they ran it on submarines. You know, did they put it on ships? How come the Allies didn't find it? Well, it's actually really an interesting problem to solve. That when you think about the Bell, right, it's actually not a huge amount. It's a large amount of stuff. But, you know, he only really took the scientists. He you know, killed a lot of the technicians and the slave labor that he used to build it. And it turns out that there's an aircraft called a Junkers 390. The Junkers 390 was originally designed to be what's called the America bomber. That it was actually specced to carry nuclear bombs that the Germans had, the Nazis had nuclear bombs. In fact, on the Wikipedia, the source of all truth I know, but on the Wikipedia, if you look up nuclear accidents, you'll find an accident with Werner Heisenberg in Germany in like the 40s.
Wow.
Like the early 40s.
Right. Okay, let me
and
just...
And that's a nuclear accident.
That's sure. That's crazy. I just wanted to lay out for the public listening, one, that you can learn more about the Bell in my presentation called Aliens from Hell. But I wanted to lay out for the listeners just a little bit about this. The Bell Project is amazing engineering of counter-rotating liquid metals that seem to have hyperdimensional qualities. And Olav, you can tell a little bit of the story of the Bell, how it seemed to vanish and reappear years later. But the reason I think the Bell Project is so important right now is because we are seeing things like the Norway Spiral or the Cloud of Care, which we are looking at charged aluminum oxide particles in the atmosphere that are being pulsed by ionospheric heaters. And these ionospheric heaters have the capability of transmissions to distant stars. So I think when we're looking at this Bell Project and we start to see some of the strange things that are occurring in our skies, then we can start to take this technology and start to understand it a little more. So counter-rotating liquid metals, you can take that to many different levels. There is also the relativistic heavy ionic collider, another particle collider like CERN, which is actually in America, colliding gold particles and causing manipulation of space-time, right? A time machine. You can look this up in my Space War News. There's absolutely going on. So this whole concept of counter-rotating liquid metals goes right into the ancient magic of Mercury and his connection to magic, and it also comes straight forward into our modern technologies as we start to look at things that deal with hyperdimensional physics. So I just wanted to make that clear for those that didn't know about the Bell Project, which is also called Die Glock. So please carry on, Ola.
Sure. Well, it's I mean, the other important thing to talk about is that aluminum oxide is one of the materials that they tested early on for dumping into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Just saying.
Yes.
But anyway, so the Junkers 390 was originally designed to be a nuclear equipped bomber. It's actually quite large, and Kammler had like six of them. But their range is not far enough to get all the way down to South America or get into Antarctica. It can roughly get over Africa before it runs out of fuel. Now, what it turns out is that there's a second aircraft, which was more prevalent, called a Junkers 290, which was actually refit to do mid-air refueling. So they actually had a mid-air refueling system in the 40s that was tested over the Atlantic and other places. But, you know, it is possible that the 390s took off and were refueled by 290s in route. And at that point, they would have had enough fuel capacity to make it to South America or to Antarctica.
So you're talking about American military jets helping carry. No. Okay. Because you had said German, it was going to be an American bomber.
No, it was designed to bomb America.
Oh, okay, I got that misread.
Because Hitler's vision was to bomb Washington D.C.
Right,
with a nuclear bomb, and to bomb New York.
Right,
they actually ran a test run over New York.
Okay, so now we've seen that the Nazis have the capability of long distance travel carrying these heavy loads. We have this mysterious base in Antarctica, which how much of a role does that play? And have you studied that?
Well, I think, you know, the Russians actually have been quite convinced that the 211 has been real for decades. I mean, they actually a few years ago put out a really interesting documentary trying to prove that base 211 existed in Antarctica. And the guys that they have on this documentary, once it was translated, in fact, I think the Sala, his people translated it, but basically it's you know, they're like admirals and like guys who teach at the Russian Naval Academy. I mean, these guys aren't slouches. But basically what I think happened is that, you know, it's not a facility you could really occupy for a long period of time. It would be very hard to sustain it. So I think they went to that facility, they built the Haunabu or whatever, you know, UFO you want to believe in. I think it was a Haunabu. I think they built a series of Haunabu, and they boarded it and took off.
In case you guys don't know, sorry, Olaf, but yeah, Haunabu is the Nazi flying saucer that, you know, there are
There's
many.
Schomburger, the Vortex engine. There are a few different ones, but the Haunabu is the best. It's a, it looks like a prototypical UFO, and it's the best candidate for housing the bell. And I think they took off. I think they went somewhere. You know, I would argue they probably went to Venus, because we really don't do anything with Venus. We landed a few probes there and said, oh, there's sulfuric acid rain, and never went back.
Yeah, now let's just be clear on that, too, because when they launched that probe into the Venus atmosphere, which was supposed to just eat it apart with acid.
It didn't.
It landed with a parachute.
It landed with a parachute. It didn't get burned up, yeah.
So there's lots of space we don't know.
It didn't last long. It only lasted. It lasted under an hour, I think. And then they claimed that it melted and whatever. But, you know, I think that's
a lot like our Phobos missions, I guess.
Right. But we seem to have a fixation with Mars. So I think they probably went to. And one of the other interesting things that I would add, the reason that I believe this, and the ultimate reason I think that the secret space fleet exists, so to speak, but, you know, you take a look at a lot of the abductions, right? That if you look at the actual transcripts of the early interviews with Betty and Barney Hill, they don't describe being abducted by aliens.
Is that right?
Yeah, they describe, Barney Hill describes being abducted by a bunch of guys in black jumpsuits with silver piping that he said looked a lot like Nazis.
Huh.
And the guy that actually led them around the ship when they were abducted, you can look all this stuff up. I'm not nuts. The guy who led them around the ship at the time was a redheaded Irishman. The reason that that's significant is that the during World War II, well, if you've got a bunch of fascists, right? And, you know, we pretty much told the fascists, you're not welcome here, pretty on a global level, right? Because they're really not. Nobody needs a fascist, okay? But, you know, we pretty much told all the fascists to get lost. So it would seem to be logical that if I was of that proclivity and I was going to leave, I'd take a bunch of my friends with me. So you'd expect to see people from Scandinavia who were fascists. You'd expect to see Italians. You'd expect to see Spaniards and a lot of, you know, some French. You know, a lot of people where this stuff was prevalent at the time. I'm not saying it is now, but at the time there were large factions that were fascists under Franco and Mussolini, etc. Well, one of the things that people don't realize is the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, at the time of World War II, was actually aligned with the Germans, that they received equipment and training from the Germans in order to cause problems for the English. So you had a regular movement of people from Ireland who were part of the IRA going to Nazi Germany to get equipment and to be trained on like Panzerfausts and, you know, and the machine guns and all the other stuff that they had, guns of fire around corners and all that stuff. They had a regular transit path. So the idea that Betty and Barney, and that's something not a lot of people know, but the idea that Betty and Barney Hill are being walked around a spaceship, quote unquote spaceship, by a redheaded Irishman actually makes a lot of sense.
Crazy. All right.
But it leads into the problem, right? I think what you got is basically two factions. I think you have a global Earth faction, and I think you've got a fascist faction. And I think that the fascist faction, a la, you know, Iron Sky, they want to go home.
Yeah. So this is basically what you're saying is two breakaway civilizations going in different directions.
Yeah, and I think that the one extraterrestrial, I guess you'd say, because they're not on Earth.
Right.
That group, the fascist group, you know, they have people here. They're coming here, you know, they're doing things. I mean, if you look at abductions and implants and things, you know, the first time I ever heard about an implant, you know, it really struck me. It, you know, it was like listening to Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, you know, that
right?
Yeah. I remember, what's his name? The guy, their adventurer guy.
Yeah.
I remember him sitting in a helicopter. It was like a Jet Ranger, you know, with a dart gun, shooting buffaloes, shoving implants into the buffaloes so they could tag them.
That's right.
You know, and if you look at things like cattle mutilations, they take things that are protein rich. They take things that could be used, you know, as base material to create other foodstuffs. They take stuff that could be tested to see environmental impact, you know, liver things, you know, genitals, things like that.
Sure.
You know, so you can use that to see what kind of condition the earth is in. You know, they take people, they interrogate them. And I was actually listening to George Knapp the other night, and he had a guy on who wrote a book about food interactions with aliens. So apparently not only do they take them, they interrogate them, they experiment on them, then they feed them, which I find to be quite odd.
Now I'm getting a little confused because we were discussing the human factor, but are you now talking about an alien factor?
No, I think they're humans. I think either through suggestion or mind control programs or whatever. I think that a lot of these, it's more of a MIL lab scenario. I think a lot of these abductions are actually human to human interaction, and they're, because a lot of times, you know, these people they have like symbols that represent the aliens when they're abducted. The owl, for example, you know, that a lot of people have this kind of, they're not grays or owls, and they do, their brain does superimposition to say, well, I can't deal with what happened to me, so I'm going to project something else.
Right. They put that in the movie.
Right.
Yeah. Can't think of the name of it, but yeah.
but you know, I think that a lot of, you know, I read about these abductions. Now I hear about a guy talking about abductions where they feed people. It's like an alien is not going to come down here and make you pancakes.
Right.
A human's going to do that.
All right. I can live with that.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I do believe that aliens exist. I've seen UFOs. I've seen at least one that I do believe was not human, you know. Uh-huh. But I think a lot of the interactions that we see, a lot of the aircraft that we see, the UFOs are aircraft. I mean, especially the triangular ones. You know, I fall more into the Hynek Valley model of, well, 10% of them are, I think it was Hynek that said it mostly, that 10% of them are unexplainable.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, galactic anthropologists, whatever you want to call them, it's adventurers, who knows. But the thing that I attribute to that is that when you look at a sighting or you look at an interaction, and I think there have been abductions that are aliens, if you look at that interaction, if you look at the one that makes no rational sense whatsoever, right? Mm-hmm. Like a Travis Walton, they didn't get anything out of that guy. They basically probed him and, you know, and terrorized him.
Yeah. Yeah.
That sounds alien to me.
Right.
Because by virtue of the fact that they're aliens, their logic totally defies our own.
Right.
We can't even begin to comprehend why they would do anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Imagine living in the insect world. Right. What a crazy place that is. You know, you got things shooting acid at you out of their butt.
Sure.
And, you know, killing is just a part of the mating, you know. It's
absolutely.
It's normal. You just, right. Yeah.
You eat your spouse. I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Well, all right. We are wrapping up the end of this hour here, and we're still working towards the technologies, the understanding. We're going to go back to Hans Kammler and the Nazis, bring this thing back up through the Solar Warden Project. Maybe we'll discuss the Black Knight and many other things here with this wonderful guest, Olav Phillips. His website is anomalies.net. You want to go check this out, his book, The Secret Space Age. So check these out. He is also a publisher at Steam Shovel Press. So getting all that knowledge out to you is Olav's goal. He is a prolific writer. He's been in Paranoia Magazine, many other articles and books. I mean, his books were too long for me to list here. So just check out Olav Phillips at anomalies.net. And Olav, do you have anything up and coming, some of the things you want to share with the audience before we move on over into the members section?
No, you know, I guess so. I've got a new issue of Steam Shovel Press I'm starting to work on. And then I've got a new issue of Mysterious Magazine that I'm working on. So check those out. You know, check out the website. I'm always writing. Steam Shovel Press. We've got some amazing articles by people like Adam Gorightly, A.K. Wilkes. He wrote a fantastic article about Valis and Robert Anton Wilson and Philip K. Dick and their interactions with aliens. So check it out.
Yeah, we're going to have to get into some of that in the next hour as well. Talk a little bit about Tomorrowland and some Disney programming. Oh, my God. You guys, if you haven't seen Tomorrowland yet and you're a fan of the show, you know, check it out with the eyes that you have to see, because everything we're talking about right here, right now, is being promoted out to the world through this Disney propaganda. So not that I recommend giving Disney your money, but it is worth a look to understand, because as Olav is showing us with the production of the mockumentary Alternative 3 all the way back in 1977, they're trying to tell us something, and we should figure this story out. So stay tuned, and members, move on over to the member section as we join Olav for another hour as we get into Solar Warden, the Nazi connection, and the breakaway civilizations. I want to thank you all for tuning in. Don't forget to get on over to freemantv.com and check out all the extras there, because believe me, I put a lot of work into that website, and there's a lot more for you to see there than you get through the streams. So check out freemantv.com. I want to thank all of you subscribers for keeping us going. It's so important to get this information out to the world, and this is your gift to the world by supporting this show. Thank you for the donations. And if you guys ever want to just chip in to help out, you know, pick up a DVD, pick up a copy of Weird Stuff, help your friends with that, and help Olav keep going. Get over there to anomalies.net and pick up his books on the Secret Space Program. So until next week, stay vigil, stay happy, and go make some friends. We'll see you all on the other side.